Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. We, the members of the International Society for Krishna Consciousness, under the tutelage of His Divine Grace Srila A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, wish to present to the world that the teachings of Lord Krishna in Bhagavad Gita and the teachings of the avatar of Lord Krishna, Srila Vyasadeva, in Srimad Bhagavatam are the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. We wish to present this as an alternative worldview among the many worldviews, various shades and sizes and varieties of worldviews being propagated, among which the overarchingly prominent and promoted is what we may call the scientific worldview, which, if you go against it in orthodoxy or academia, or even in the mass media, well, you don't, that's the point, you don't. You get cut out, you're not allowed to, because science is truth, right? That's what you learn when you're sent off at a young age for your forced child abuse. We're all victims of child abuse because we all got bundled off to those indoctrination camps that they call schools. Jails come indoctrination camps in which the most important... Well, I don't know what they taught in your country, but in England we learn important things like 1066 is the year when England was invaded by William the Conqueror and all kinds of things which are very useful in our lives. The one thing we learn is that science is truth. If a scientist says it must be true, and we members of the International Society for Krishna Consciousness are, as I said, under the tutelage of His Divine Grace Srila A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, who talk quite a lot about science and scientists. He had some common terms which he used for scientists. One of the most common terms was fools, another was rascals. It's difficult to get the message across when we go up against what we can call the scientific worldview. But there is hope. There is hope, because despite the fact that what is called science has such a predominating position in the world, such that if you present something which is considered unscientific, it's just not allowed to propagate. One example I can give, he's dead now, it happens to all of us sooner or later. Fred Hoyle was highly respected in the world of astronomy. In fact, he got knighted by the Queen and became Sir Fred Hoyle and was a member of the Royal Astronomical Society. He was huge in astronomy, maybe the most respected figure in the world in astronomy. And one time he was gazing out through his telescope. Actually, they don't gaze out through telescopes anymore. They look at a computer screen like all of us do for pretty much everything we do. He had looking at his telescope at the red shifts. The red shift is what proves Big Bang Theory. And he looked at it and he thought, well, this doesn't prove Big Bang Theory at all. It looks like solid state. Nothing's moving at all. And from being the greatest hero in the astronomical world, he became rejected as a fool and a rascal for propagating things which are unscientific. Unscientific in this context means something that those most scientists or those that hold power, that means who can appoint you to positions, who can give you funding for your science projects, they don't agree with you. But anyway, it's not that despite all this heavy propaganda and politics in science, there are people who dare to speak out about this, and they're not simply voices in the wilderness. I'm going to quote from a talk by Rupert Sheldrake. This was not just a talk. This wasn't just some teeny-weeny Bhaktivikasa Swami speaking, adding to the number of YouTube videos piling up every day. This was a TED talk. A TED talk. They wouldn't put me on a TED talk. That's for sure. I mean, I guess I could if I rewired my message to talk some nonsense. But TED, what does that stand for? Technology, education, and development, is it? Something like that. TED talk. So he's on a TED talk on January the 13th, 2013, and he gave a talk called The Science Delusion. Oh, there you go. This is very scientific. I've got one reference, January the 13th, 2013. I have another reference, January the 12th, 2013. Looks like our scholars, one of them maybe fell asleep. His talk was too boring. It wasn't very boring. Here's a quote from his talk. The most common belief, to use that word belief in relation when to scientists, they don't like that at all. If you call their science a belief, oh, it's like, anyway, a good analogy, a sufficiently comical analogy doesn't come to my mind at the present time, so I'll pass up on that joke, which didn't happen. The most common belief is that all the laws of nature were completely fixed at the moment of the Big Bang. For those of you who have never heard of the Big Bang, and all of you have heard, by the way, the term Big Bang was given by Fred Hoyle as a joke. He thought it was a joke, and it became, because it's such a silly idea. It's the general idea is that before the Big Bang, there was nothing. Mind you, I am a layman, so I might be getting some of the details wrong, but this is how I understand it. There was nothing. Absolute nothingness. Then there was an explosion. There was nothing to explode, but anyway, it exploded. And then, hey presto, throw in a few billion years, and here we all are at Cambridge University discussing it all. It's called a singularity. Singularity means something unexpected. It happened once, doesn't happen always, but it happened once. And the evidence is the redshifts, which I can't remember, I should have looked it up, but I didn't bother. And it shows that, because we see, when we look at the stars at night, we see it in 2D, right? How are you going to find out how this star, you see one star, next to it is another star, but actually they might be millions of light years away, but you can't tell because we're seeing in 2D, but the red shift shows us the distance between them, and that also shows, so it shows that by looking at the sky, you see that the planets, they're all moving out, so there must have been some initial thrust, the explosion, we're all part of an ongoing explosion. Anyway, the most common belief is that all the laws of nature were completely fixed at the moment of the Big Bang. Modern science is based on the principle, give us one free miracle and we'll explain the rest. The one free miracle is the appearance of all the matter and energy in the universe and all the laws that govern it from nothing in a single instant. Right? We have all the laws. We have all the constants and Hubble's constant and the entropy and this and all the laws of the universe, the laws of the, they just happen to come into existence, very scientifically, at the beginning of the universe. How, why, what, where, when, and don't ask questions like that. But anyway, that happened. And then if you just, we can explain everything after that. So Rupert Sheldrake said this in a TED talk, and there was some protest about this from people who didn't like what he said. And then TED took it out of circulation, took it off their website. No, actually it said it was put on their website, but non-prominently with a warning label. And room for discussion was made, just like I gave, I held a conference for discussion of that book of mine, which was banned, so to speak, and let those who object to it, let them come and discuss. They didn't turn up. So in the same way, well, I'm very small compared to all these things. Those who condemned the talk never showed up, but there was a huge outrage against this. Why is it being banned? Free speech. He spoke coherently, he had a good message, and before banning the video, it had 35,000 views. Since then, over 5 million views. It also has been dubbed in various levels and with subtitles in more than 20 languages. So, the talks, the comments on this have exceeded those for any other TED talk. So, even though our propositions that we present might seem to be unscientific or anti-scientific, and some of our devotees say, well, we can't make any headway, but there are a lot of people out there who, despite the barrage of propaganda about science, are not convinced that it's actually true. That's good. Otherwise, if you go up against the what we call the orthodoxy in academia and science, it's like their ears are blocked to us, that they can't listen. As soon as you say religion, oh, okay, all right, get in that corner. You don't belong here. We're talking about reality. Right? They say science is fact and religion is belief. And you can believe in it, but it's basically it's all rubbish. Richard Dawkins, The God Delusion. Notice the title, this Richard Sheldrake, he made his TED talk called The Science Delusion. It's another delusion. It's a fantasy. So, They think that science is right. If you say science, it must be right. Right? When you go to school, it's the way they talk about science. This is fact. We're talking about facts. It's a scientific education. Science. This is science. And religion. There's very strong prejudice against religion and revelation, because we believe in revelation. Revelation means knowledge is given to us from a non-human source, a higher source, a transcendental source, a divine source, God. But that's non-scientific. Non-scientific, well, We looked in our telescopes, we looked in our microscopes, we looked in our test tubes, we did our calculations, and we didn't find God, so there can't be any God. Makes sense, doesn't it? Well, does it make sense? Does it make sense? Does it make sense? This is the materialistic worldview, secular humanist worldview, dating back to when? The father of modern science, so they say, Descartes. And then before him there was Galileo and Copernicus. And before that, laying the foundations for the materialistic worldview is Protagoras. You've all heard of Protagoras. No, you haven't. Anyway, they say Protagoras said in ancient Greek, not in English. There wasn't any English language at the time. Can you believe it? That the people were such savages. They didn't speak English. But they did speak Greek. So, not modern Greek, ancient Greek. So ancient Greek, Protagoras, he said, man is the measure of all things. Actually, he's not the founder of this secular, humanistic, secularistic worldview. It's going on since time immemorial, as Lord Krishna states in Bhagavad Gita, that pravritiṃ ca nivritiṃ ca janāna vidura asuraha asatyam apratiṣṭam te jagadāhuraniśvaram aparaspara sambhutam kimanyat kama haitukam. Persons of demoniac disposition, asuras, they say that there's no ultimate reality, there's no ultimate truth, there's no God in control of this universe. It's going on, but there's no controller. And aparaspara sambhutam, everything comes, there's no intrinsic harmonizing principle in the universe. Just, it's all vague interactions, David Hume. Everything's just, nothing is ultimately related to anything else. They're just little bits of things here and there, and they vaguely interact. And well, maybe there was a cause. Lust, sex. That's really the point of life. I'm paraphrasing here, but anyway, this is from Bhagavad Gita, which came, if we accept according to our tradition, not according to how our scientifically minded friends or enemies reshape history to fit their theories. Then Bhagavad Gita was spoken before Protagoras. Man is the measure of all things. In other words, what we men understand, men here including women, because that's the way the English language used to be. Mankind, you have to say humankind. Man is the measure of all things. Actually, now it's woman is the measure of all things, right? Because man had it for so many centuries, and it's time for the women. But Protagoras was a man, so he was obviously a male chauvinistic pig, apart from being an ancient Greek philosopher. So Protagoras said that man is, in other words, what we can measure, touch, taste, smell, feel. Measurement, science is based on measurements, precise measurements. But if we go down to the subatomic level, my dear friends, what is meant by a precise measurement? Because everything's always moving. There is no such thing as a point. It's only a concept. For that matter, there's no such number. 2 + 2 = 4. You learn that at school, right? Even before you learn the word science. 2 + 2. What does it mean? 2 + 2 = 4. Well, it's only a concept. It's not. It's something which you can apply to what we call reality. Bring 2 oranges and 2 oranges, and you have 4 oranges. Right? But then someone has to explain this, but I can never understand. How do you get up to E equals mc squared? Energy equals mass times the speed of light squared. Now, how do you know the speed of light is always constant everywhere? It's not provable. And the speed of light, okay, you get, but it's not the speed. You can't multiply the speed of light by mass. You can't multiply Chitta Hari by Sri Ram, because then you can multiply numbers. You can't say energy equals. You can say the number which represents energy. You can deduce that from the number that represents mass by the number. But anyway, I'm getting out of my depth here, obviously. But anyway, 2 plus 2 equals 4. Okay, it's all about measuring, right? And when we measure everything, and we put everything in categories, and that's called science. And we do it when we're men, and we understand what is reality. And if we can't, it's something that we cannot ascertain, something that we cannot measure, can't be science. Well, that rules out Big Bang, doesn't it? Well, we can speculate about it. Does anyone want to replicate Big Bang in their laboratory? You just make a big vacuum, that's all, and just wait for wait. But you can't replicate the condition, because even if you make a vacuum the size of the Houston Astrodome or something like that, but it's still enclosed within fixed boundaries. It's nothing within something, so you can't replicate. Anyway, Protagoras lived, according to one entry on the internet, which I looked up, which is different to another entry on the internet, slightly different. He lived from 490 BC to 420 BC, approximately, which is a very awkward way of measuring someone's or time back to front, 490 to 420, because BC, it's Christian, the Christian era, which was imagined by some Pope Gregory, and he imagined Jesus was born 2,020 years ago, and anything before that, that doesn't count as being history, or it doesn't really matter. It's a very awkward way of measuring time, not a very scientific method. So man is the measure of all things. It's pretty arrogant, isn't it? When you think, here we are, we're men, and we understand. It's the anthropocentric worldview. Man is at the center of everything. Naturally led to the geocentric worldview, which was debunked by Copernicus and Galileo. But they never threw out the anthropocentric worldview. If you think that, well, actually, if we look up at the stars at night, they actually look very close, but then we understand they're very far away, and then we start looking at them through telescopes, and we wonder what's going out there, so we get better and better telescopes, and we look, and we discover different things, and then we discover, well, maybe the Earth is not such a great, this Earth is just one tiny little planet, and there are millions and billions and trillions and quadrillions and zillions, and who knows how many things are out there. And we're all very insignificant, but still man is the measure of all things. That's still the idea, that by science we will understand. It's like, I'll tell you a story about an ant called Christopher Columbus. He was nicknamed Christopher Columbus. He was sent out by Queen Ant, go and explore. So he went out and explored, and he crawled all over my body and made a big exploration, went to the Galapagos Islands, came back down again, and went back to the queen and said, well, I saw lots of forests and there were some valleys and mountains, no sign of life anywhere. No sign of, so we look out at the universe, only humans, no sign of life. It's not within his ability to understand that this body is alive and real. He is as if in a different universe. Now, I learned at school, and this is all very scientific, that there's only life on Earth, because very, very rare, and there has to be so many conditions have to be fulfilled, the atmosphere and the chemicals and this and that, and you have to have lightning bolts, not sent by God or Zeus, but just from somewhere. And then it zaps the chemicals, and then they start to evolve into the chemicals. They all start bubbling in some primordial soup, and then they all... Excuse me. Change of position. Physical, not ideological. So we learned at school and from TV programs which helped to educate us, the good old BBC. I was, after all, born in England and not in a backward country like Croatia, where they only recently started to speak English. So, yeah, they have the nice BBC, which gives us all good educational programs, and it's all very neutral. See, the BBC, they just want to give you the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, which is that real civilization begins at the source of the River Thames. If you haven't heard of the River Thames, then go back to Croatia. Then we learn that there can only be life on Earth because there's so many conditions which have to be fulfilled. But now I don't know what happened. I have to ask some scientists if they'll give me the time of day to ask them. But now we hear there are so many planets in our galaxy which have life. If you find water, that means there must be life. But there are a hell of a lot more conditions, even according to their theories, than just having water. So anyway, that's a major change, isn't it? When you went to school in Croatia, Gokul Chandra, what did they teach you? Was there life on planets or not at that time? No, out of the question. Out of the question. But it's changed, right? What about you, Chitahari? You must be around the same age, right? Well, I wonder what they teach the kids at school now. God knows what they do. Come to school one day in boys' clothes, come the next day in girls' clothes. And by science, if you don't like to be a boy, we can make you into a girl. So anyway, what we are up against is the scientific worldview that we can understand everything by our own efforts. But it's like the ant. We're tiny living beings in a universe which is so vast we don't even know if we're even beginning to understand it. And we're so arrogant that we think we do understand it, we understand it to the extent that we can rubbish and belittle anyone who doesn't agree with what we think is right. But a major problem with this is that what they think is right generally becomes wrong after some time. I've given this proposition a few times that, okay, let's just postulate that the world goes on in pretty much the same way it's been going on for the last few hundred years, say for the last 500 years, and scientific research continues. Okay, so if we come back in 1,000 years and they look back and they say the science of the year 2020, what do you think of that? Very primitive and backward, right? That's what they'd say. If we go back 500 years, what they call science, they're all very primitive and backward. So if we go forward in time 500 years, they'll say what we think is science now, very primitive and backward. That means it's very primitive and backward. That means that although we think we know, we don't know, because we can be pretty sure that their science will change as it continues to change. Scientists do die after all. That's how new scientific theories get accepted. The old scientists die. This is accepted in the philosophies. I'm not just joking. It's Thomas Kuhn, The Nature of Scientific Revolutions, one of the most important books of the 21st century, 20th century, of even the materialists will understand that. He pointed out in this book that scientists, they are after all human beings, they have biases and prejudices and so on and so on. Okay, so let's go forward a bit to Einstein. Okay, big jump there from Protagoras through Pythagoras and way up to Einstein. Einstein, you've all heard the name of Einstein. Albert Einstein. He's not the only Einstein in the world. There are other people with that name. But generally when we say Einstein, we mean Albert Einstein, the physicist. Okay, so one of the things that Einstein postulated is that we live in a multi-dimensional universe. Actually, that was already accepted, even before Einstein said so. At least four dimensions. Accepted. There's length, height, width, and time. So four dimensions. So that's multi. I guess you can begin multi even at the beginning, even from three up. But multi-dimensional. I mean, there are so many dimensions we're not aware of, and this and that. And that's this postulate has given room for things like string theory, and I don't know what string theory is, except that they postulate multi-dimensions to try to explain things which they can't otherwise explain. Okay, multi-dimensionalism. Let's think about it. We just had the example of the ant, the ant with the nickname Christopher Columbus. He couldn't relate to the reality of my existence because I'm as if in another universe. As if in another universe, because it's not within his power of measurement. Ant is the measure of all things. Man is the measure of all things. Okay, let's take a little example here. All right, I agree to meet Mr. X. Allein Building. You've heard of the Allein Building in Bur Dubai. It's in Bur Dubai, right? Yeah. Allein Building. Okay, I'll meet you at the Allein Building at 10 o'clock tomorrow morning. Okay. So he goes in the Allein Building. If you look on the map, you can find it's at a certain... what do they call that? The coordinates, that's right. Latitude, longitude. You find its position on the map. So coordinates, that's longitude. Coordinates means longitude, latitude. So that's two dimensions, right? So you got a third dimension, which is the time. So 10 o'clock. So, and then you meet each, you didn't meet. Then they meet again the next day by chance. So what happened? I was there at 10 o'clock. I was there too. Why didn't we meet? Because when you said, I'll meet you at the Aline building tomorrow, person A, or myself, thought that, well, I have an office in the Aline building, and he must know that. The office is on the fifth floor. So when I say Aline building, he should come to my office. But he didn't know that, and he thinks we'll meet in the foyer, in the lobby. So we were missing one dimension. We were both in the same place at the same time, but I was on the fifth floor and he was in the lobby. So we were dimensionally, we were in the same place, but we missed one dimension, the height dimension. And so we didn't meet at all. We weren't aware of each other's presence, although in certain dimensions we were present, but in other dimensions we were not present. So the Vedas offer the prospect of a universe in which there are many things described. For instance, what we would call human-like creatures with four arms, six arms, eight arms, 10 arms, 12 arms, 1,000 arms. You may say, well, I didn't see such a thing. Can't imagine any such thing could exist. The Vedic knowledge, or if you want to put it this way, Indian mystic knowledge, gives access to dimensions, levels of perception, which are not available ordinarily. You may say, well, why should we believe? The yogis, they can go into mystic trance and go within, they say there's the Hridaya Akash, the sky in the heart, and the yogis enter that and they see Vishnu, and they can see different worlds, they can read people's minds, and so many things like that. Why should we believe? Our scientists will say. So-called scientists. Actually, this is very much coming from the West, because even more than 50 years ago in Russia, they didn't have the same prejudices, because their scientific culture grew up differently. So they were openly studying ESP, extrasensory perception, and things like this, and parapsychology. They don't have a hang-up about that, but in the Western world, they have a hang-up, and the Western world triumphed in the Cold War. So, but even scientists, hardcore scientists, the kind of scientists who would object to Rupert Sheldrake's cogently presented lecture, which didn't agree with their worldview, they all agree that there are aspects of reality which ordinarily we can't, you and me, and even the scientist himself, there are aspects of reality all around us which we are not aware of. And only by some very special training can you begin to access them and understand them. For instance, subatomic particles. Oh, what's going on in this room at the present time? We could say that people are sitting here, I am sitting here, the air is blowing in, such and such a temperature, this and that. Okay, even the temperature you can't measure just by, but you can feel generally it's fairly pleasant, not hot, not cold. Okay, but then there, another view of reality is that there's a mass of energy of subatomic particles whizzing around at huge speeds, and there's radio waves and infrared light, ultraviolet light. There may be sounds. There may be sound waves which we're not aware of, which a dog could hear, because the dogs can hear at a much higher pitch than humans, which we can't hear at all. Dogs They see through their nose more than through their eyes. That's why the dog, if you in the Western country, the dog will come and sniff you, and they try and understand who you are by sniffing you. They don't see very well, so we're told by the scientists. They sniff. So there are all kinds of aspects of reality around us which we are not aware of, but if we're trained, we can become aware of them. So this is our Vedic proposition, that there are levels of reality which you cannot access simply by the scientific method. Or there's a different levels of reality even than the scientists want to understand. Actually, the Western world has been in contact with the yogis of India for quite a long time now. I remember on TV, on BBC as a kid, seeing a program in which they put an Indian yogi, in those days yogi meant an Indian, in a glass cage, like completely enclosed, and made a vacuum, and said, okay, because you know you can't go without breathing. Normally people can't live for more than 2 or 3 minutes without breathing. So I said, okay, we're gonna put him in a vacuum, and whenever he'll go without breathing, and he'll be there for at least 20 minutes. When he's ready, he'll just tick, 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 and hope that we hear him, and we open the glass case, and the air comes in, and he can breathe again. So he's put in a vacuum, and after half an hour or so, boom, 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 the program is going on with so many other things. It was a children's program. And then, okay, and then he came out. So scientifically proven that human beings can, or at least one, this human being, and he claims to be part of an ancient tradition, that they can hold their breath. They can go without breathing for much longer than the common man. So, and they have some mystic powers which they can access. The scientists don't claim to have mystic powers, but they claim to have access to reality at a level that the common man cannot have. Theoretically they could have, but they don't have, because the average person hasn't. Just like we talk about subatomic particles. How do we know they exist? What are the symptoms? I don't think anyone in this room could say, but if you're trained in atomic physics, you could. You should be able to do so. So they're saying that we have access to knowledge of reality, but we're also saying we have access to knowledge of reality, which you can also access, but you have to accept our methodology. And say, well, it's not scientific. Why not scientific? Well, we said it's not scientific. That's not scientific to say like that. And we criticize that. You see, you're saying there was nothing, and then there was an explosion, and then, woo! All the laws of science just came into being. Wow. Doesn't sound possible. Well, what's our version of how the universe, this manifested material universe, came into being? Okay, I'll give a summary. The Big Bang Theory, I gave a summary, which probably Big Bang theorists would disagree with, but then they disagree among themselves also. Okay, Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. He plays a flute and he dances with his friends in the land called Golok Vrindavan, the spiritual world far beyond this material existence, where there is no birth, no death, no old age, no disease, and Krishna manifests a portion of himself who lies down on a snake bed, and from his body, he's lying down in a state of sleep, apparent sleep, and as he breathes out, from the pores of his hairs come out universes in seed form, and then they expand. It's a little bit like Big Bang, a little bit, because the universes go from his body, and then when he breathes in, they come in again. And then he enters, he expands himself by his transcendental potency and enters within every universe. Tell me if I'm getting anything wrong here. Gokul Chandra, you're the expert on this guy. But this is also, I'm very basic what I'm seeing. He enters again as another Vishnu form in each universe, which is half filled with water, and he lies on another snake. And then from his navel comes a lotus, and then a four-headed figure. We don't only have ten-handed, we have four-headed and ten-headed and multiple-headed beings in the Vedic worldview. And anyway, Brahma, and then from his different mouths, he comes the Vedic hymns, and from his mind come the Manasajata, the progenitors of the universe. And very brief summary, that is the world comes from Narayana and manifests through the pores of his body, and there's a sub-creator called Brahma, and then Brahma, and then there's Shiva, and there are different demigods, and the universe is controlled by various demigods under the aegis of Lord Vishnu. So that's the Vedic world. It just sounds impossible, doesn't it? It's just like impossible. How can you accept such a thing? It just sounds like a fantasy. Well, the Big Bang Theory sounds like a big fantasy also. Actually, we accept that it's a fantasy. We accept. It's Mahavishnu. He's dreaming. So dreaming is like a fantasy, isn't it? But the thing is, with Mahavishnu's dream, there's a level of reality. Mahavishnu's dream or fantasy is the reality that we live in, but we're all living in a dream, Mahavishnu's dream. And we also have our own dream. We dream phantasmagorically. I am Russian, I am Chinese, I am black, I am white, I am a rich man, I'm a very strong man, I'm a Hindu, I'm a Muslim. This is all just a dream, because in the sense it's a fantasy, because we have one body and we die again. And then we get another body. And then right now I'm thinking, I am an Englishman, I am almost 64 years old, this body is me, but it's true in one sense, but it's not true in another sense. It's like a dream. When you're in a dream, you think that the dream state is real, but it's not, because it's temporary. And that's the same thing. We get this body and it's temporary. So it's a dream, it's a fantasy. So we accept that the Vedic worldview is that this world that we live in, it's a fantasy. But we say that the idea there's a Big Bang, there's no controller, that's a fantasy. So choose your fantasy. We have a fantasy which is the fantasy of God, or the fantasy which is the fantasy of a man who's man is the measure of all things. Here's a scientific fantasy. Now, Richard Dawkins, the God delusion man, and the blind watchmaker man, and all these, he's very busy trying to prove that there's no God. He talks of the God of the gaps, that when you can't explain something, you say, well, it must be God. And then science, it fills in the gap. And then they find out, and then they don't say it's God anymore. He said, well, there's a scientific explanation. But the thing is, you're never going to know everything. There are going to be always so many things unexplained. But the scientists, they do the same thing. Among the scientific laws which they say are necessary to understand the world as we understand it through science, the laws of gravitation. And how are the planets all moving? Well, according to the Vedic fantasy, or the Vedic lore, L-O-R-E, or the Krishna's law, L-A-W, they're all going, all the planets are going on under the direction of Govinda, Krishna. All the planets move under his direction. But according to the so-called scientific fantasy. There are various forces at work. Gravitational force is necessary to explain how the planets which are all moving, just like they say, the Earth is going around the Sun. Well, why does it go around the Sun? Why does it just float off? Have the Earth liberation movement. Yeah, I'm fed up of being dependent on the Sun. Let's have a divorce. But they're held by gravity. But there's just enough gravity so the Earth doesn't get pulled into the Sun. So the law of gravity is essential for understanding. But there's a problem because there should, to make the law of gravity work according to their calculations, you need a lot more mass in the universe than is observed. 84%, there should be a hell of a lot more. 84% of it, we can't observe it. So, we have to do something scientific. What we'll do is, we'll invent it, okay. There must be that mass in the universe, otherwise our theory doesn't work, right? So it's called dark mass or invisible matter, dark matter. Because if you didn't have that, the universe, either everything would just spin off, or everything would just... everything would go back to an original point, Big Bang in reverse. So, it's very science. It's a fantasy. It's something made up. It's just like dark matter, right? Dark matter. It must be there. So it's just like you can say somewhere, okay, I want to marry this girl. How much money have you got in your bank balance? Show me. It says 20 rupees. But actually, it's 20,000 crores. The only thing is, you can't see those extra zeros. It's actually there, but you can't see it. It's not going to be very convincing. It's dark dollars. You tell them. I overdrew on my credit account, but the bank manager calls you in. Of course, nowadays it's all virtual. So what's going on? No, the money's there. It's just that you can't see it. That's all. So there are many things like that actually in science, what they call science. I gave one quote. Let's give another quote. Whoops, I'm looking on them. I made my notes, but I'm going out of order. Here, okay. Here is a quote from the year 2015, not ancient mumbo jumbo. This is fairly modern. Here's a report about, it's from the Parkes Observatory in Australia, where they're studying radiation from space to try to understand what's going on. So it came in a journal under what happened. At this Parkes Observatory in Australia, they had is very famous among astronomers, the radio telescope. They were picking up strange signals. From time to time, there would be a massive burst of energy on their computer radar. And this was circulated among astronomers throughout the world. There are all kinds of theories. What could be causing it? And then after 17 years, they found out what it is that in the cafeteria at the observatory, they had a microwave oven. And sometimes they opened the door a few seconds early while the microwave was still going on, which would generate a massive burst on their screen. Had all these theories, you know, big theories, and they were all discussing it in conferences, and he was a microwave oven. Okay, that's one of the stories. On the cover of the highly prestigious magazine called the Scientific American, not the Scientific Indian, Scientific American, in May 2014. On the big heading, A Crisis in Physics, ? Then the subheading, If Supersymmetry Does Not Pan Out, Scientists Will Need a New Way to Explain the Universe.
A new way to explain the universe.
Well, from what you get at school, TV and the internet, it looks like they already got it worked out, right? Maybe they're not so sure. Okay, from another highly prestigious magazine, Nature magazine. These are the kind of magazines, if you get quoted in that magazine, you are a real high-grade scientist. Nature magazine, September the 1st, 2015. Talking about the replication crisis. Scientists have found that the results of many scientific studies are difficult or impossible to replicate on subsequent investigation. Do you understand the problem here? Because if you do a scientific experiment, you have to be able to do it and say, okay, when you do this, this happens. And then from this, we can understand something else. And then someone else has to do the same experiment and get the same result. And when a number of them do it and get the same result, you can accept, okay, that's scientifically accepted. So scientific replication is required. But scientists have found that the results of many scientific studies are difficult or impossible to replicate on subsequent investigation, either by independent researchers or the original researchers themselves. The world of science is in the middle of unprecedented soul-searching at present. Soul-searching? I thought they didn't believe in souls. The credibility of science rests on the widespread assumption that the results are replicable and that high standards are maintained by anonymous peer review. These pillars are crumbling. Oh. Okay. These are all scientists. But what about Stephen Hawking? Now, he's a guy who doesn't get things wrong, right? He's dead now, but anyway. Stephen Hawking. BBC, it's the BBC again, July the 16th, 2004. Stephen Hawking changes his mind. What does that mean? He didn't want bacon and eggs for breakfast. He wanted to go on a vegan breakfast. He changes his mind about black holes. The world-famous author of A Brief History of Time said he and other scientists had gotten it wrong. In doing so, he lost one of the most famous bets in recent scientific history. Even Stephen Hawking can be wrong. He's now joined The Brief History of Time by going the same way that all scientists go. They all enter a black hole called the grave. Anyway, what am I getting at here? There are problems in science. It doesn't prove that everything in science, saying these things doesn't prove everything in science is wrong, but it does show that what we call science may not be as scientific as we think. Now, we may think, well, we have electron microscopes, we have the Hubble telescope, we have the Large Hadron Collider, colloquially known as an atom smasher. But by our imperfect senses, what are we doing? We're measuring things, man is the measure of all things, with our imperfect senses. And we can extend our ability to perceive by using microscopes, telescopes, and all kinds of stethoscopes and all kinds of different things. However, we're using imperfect machines, applying our imperfect senses and imperfect intelligence. So it's imperfection applied to imperfection. And you're not going to get, it's not like multiplying two negative integers. It's not that minus one times minus one equals, that is what you mean by minus one. Generally it means plus one. But it doesn't work. If you bring imperfection by imperfection, you still get imperfection. Now there is this idea that, well, we'll go on continuing to explore and dig up things from the ground and make geological research and astronomical research and atomic research and neurological research, and I'll use all kinds of big words which most people don't understand, and in this way we will gradually unlock all the secrets of the universe. Okay, in response to this, I would like to inform you that in 1912, in the good year of our Lord, 1912, the world pole vaulting record. Do you know what pole vaulting is? You get a pole, you hold it in your hand, a big long pole, and you run like anything, and then you stick it in the ground. At the same time, you jump up in the air, and there's a big bar, and you have to try and get over the bar. And if you do it well enough, you can win a gold medal at the Olympics. If you don't, you might break your back. You might win the gold medal and break your back also. Anyway, in 1912, the world record, they've been doing this thing for over 100 years, pole vaulting. The world record was 13 feet. That's not a very, 13 feet, 2 1/4 inches. That's not a very good system of measurement. Must be Americans. The metric system is actually a lot better. I mean, even scientifically, it's like the difference between Roman numerals and so-called Arabic numerals. Okay, by improved equipment and training and techniques, the record now stands, at the time I read this article, at 20 feet 2 1/2 inches. But, my dear friends, who just learned a little bit about pole vaulting, don't waste your time looking it up on the internet. Pole vaulting. The world record, it's probably changed since this article was written a few years ago, was 20 feet 2 1/2 inches. It went up by 7 feet 1/4 inch. More than half. And a great achievement, right? That you can pole vault more than 20 feet in the air. You go boing, and then you throw yourself up, and then you come boing, and you land on the other side. And you don't break your back because they have something to catch you. Okay, well, how about pole vaulting to the moon? Think man will be able to? No, you'll never be able to do that. And it's not just because of that Van Allen belt of radioactivity, which somehow the astronauts went through without a hitch when they went to the moon. One small step for man and one great step for mankind. But they didn't pole vault to the moon. Now, we can expect that the pole vaulting record will increase, but it's never going to increase to the extent that we can go to the moon. And even if you go to the moon, even according to modern astronomy, is a very, well, it's the closest extraterrestrial body of any significant size, apart from all that space junk they've thrown out into space. Now we've got plenty of extraterrestrial bodies floating around in inner space, space junk. It's the next major ecological problem coming up. We're not content to scientifically contaminate all the world with pollution, they're contaminating space also, scientifically. So what's the point here? That, okay, we have our instruments by which we can look out, and you don't look at telescopes like this, that's for baby telescopes. But real hardcore telescope, it's all computers. You look at a computer screen. The computer, it does it for you, whatever they do. But the same thing is there. We're operating within finity. There's a finite limit, very small limits to how far we can extend our sensual perception. And even if we could extend it more and more and more and more and more, we'd still be like ants crawling on a human body. We wouldn't be able to have that perception from of that of a human. We'd never be, and we don't. An ant doesn't have the intelligence to understand what a human is. Because so what we're talking about here is the arohapanta, trying to get knowledge by climbing up. Whereas we who accept the Vedic worldview, which sounds like a fantasy, we accept the avarohapanta, that knowledge, there's someone up there who knows, who can see, who can give us knowledge of what's going on down here. How can we who are limited understand that which is of far greater power than ourselves? How is it possible? How can the ant understand the human? Not possible. But what we postulate, there's an infinite power and potentate, God, that word, that unscientific word, God. God is infinite. He can give us the intelligence by which we can understand Him. He can give us the understanding to the ability that we can understand. Just a small example. Okay. Now, someone ties me up to this chair, right? So I can't move. And I want to shake hands with Gokul Chandra, who's sitting over there. I can't reach. You know, I just can't reach. I can do some yoga exercise to try to stretch my hand, but as long as he's sitting that far away, how far away is that? About 3 to 4 meters, we could say. I'm never going to be able to reach him. But if he comes to me, then, and he extends his hand, then we can very easily shake. So it's up to him. I'm tied up, he's free. He can very easily come to me. So in the same way, we are tied up within our limitations. But if someone who is free, and they extend themselves to us, then we can understand. So we say, our proposition is that reality, whatever it is, it's something far greater than we can understand with our very limited senses and intelligence. You should not reject the Vedic worldview because it sounds like a fantasy, because with just a few examples we can show that there are serious problems with what's called the scientific worldview, and that it's a fantasy to think that by our limited intelligence and senses we can understand the nature of reality. Of course, there's so many more things could be said about this. One thing is, where does the desire come from even to understand if we're all just chemicals? That's another whole big question, the nature of consciousness. So it's not that we're totally against everything scientific. For instance, see this thing here that was developed on the basis of science and technology, this microphone was developed, and you can't see it, but the viewers out there, but I can see it. There's a camera in front of me which was developed by science and technology, so we don't reject that. We don't reject science per se. We recognize, okay, they've done research, they've found out so many things, but don't go beyond your adhika, don't go beyond your jurisdiction. If you say that we can make a camera, okay, very good, thank you, we'll use it to propagate Krishna consciousness. If you say that by science we reject any understanding that doesn't fit with our preconceived, very human and limited notions, and we can't accept that. We can't accept that. So anyway, what I've said here is not going to convince any scientist or anyone who's steeped in this. And anyway, only people who already subscribe at least partially to the Vedic worldview, or they'll even be interested to listen to such a thing. I don't expect that by saying this that they're going to call me for a TED talk or give me a Nobel Prize or an honorary degree at Oxford University or any such thing. And I don't expect to get 1 billion YouTube views or any such thing. But I'm just pointing out to those of us within our community, the Vaishnava or the Vedic, we can say the Vedic community, if you want to extend that, that don't be intimidated by this idea that what is related in the Shastra, the Vedic Shastra, is just fantasy. Because even from a subjective point of view, if you say this is fantasy, well, what they call science is a lot of fantasy over there also. It's they don't have a monopoly on understanding the truth. So thank you very much, and thank you very much to His Holiness Badri Narayan Swami, whose essay in defense of the Vedic view formed the starting point and the basis and gave a lot of material for this talk. I should acknowledge that. And Hare Krishna. And now we're going to chant Hare Krishna. Hare Krishna. Dante nidhaya chirnakam padaya nipatya kritvacha kakushata metada hambravimi hey sadhava sakala eva vihaya durat gauranga chandra charane kurutanuragaha. Hare Krishna.